Cats in Hell, a look back at Saturday Night Live with your hosts, Matt and Keith. Brought to you by Lion's Den Audio Theater. Like and subscribe to Lion's Den Audio Theater for more Lion's Den goodness. And here are your hosts, Keith and Matt.
Saturday Night Live, Season 4, Episode 10, starring Michael Palin, originally aired on January 27th, 1979. Welcome to SN Hell. Welcome to 1979. My name is Keith, and with me always is my good buddy Matt. Hello, Matt.
Hey, Keith. 79. This is our year.
This is our year. The year of champions.
You know what? You know what we are on the Chinese zodiac?
We are sheep, are we not?
I wasn't sure. I was asking out of sincere curiosity.
I believe we are sheep. So yeah, at about this point in time, we were probably developing eyelids or fingernails or something.
Yep.
Oddly enough, we're born about 2 weeks apart in the summer of 79, and yet didn't really run across one another until 17 years later.
It's wild times, the 70s. Who can keep track, you know?
I know, eh? Gosh. Hey, Sean.
Hey.
It's Sean. Hello, Sean. Welcome back.
Hey, glad to be back.
Tonight's Michael Palin. He's back. How about that?
How about it?
It's Michael Palin's second appearance. First one I thought was a tad underwhelming for us, but it did straight sixes across the board. Me and you and Adrian all gave the episode sixes. The seagull, the sketch where he gets out of the trunk while doing Chekhov's The Seagull, universally thought of as the best sketch. I still think of that one. That's the one where he had the monologue where he put the cats in his pants.
Yes.
Reviewing my notes, it looked like we were less enamored with the writing on that episode than we were the actual performance. I just recently finished shooting The Life of Brian. So are you a fan of you? I know we talk about it a bit, but where are you on the Python fan scale?
No, a lot of the television show, though. So, but I mean, I liked the movies mostly. The Life of Brian was my least favorite.
Okay. I hear that more and more now. I always liked Meaning of Life. Yeah, when I was a kid, it was all Holy Grail and Life of Brian, and Meaning of Life didn't get any love at all. But I've been finding lately people have sort of been rewatching it or finding it for the first time and just loving Meaning of Life.
Yeah, it's been a while. I should rewatch it.
I'd say rewatch Life of Brian, too, if it wasn't to your fancy. I really like it. It's very applicable to today, more than the other two are.
That's fair. It's been like I only watched it the one time, and it was like 20, 25 years ago, I'm sure.
Great film. Michael Palin has very detailed diaries that he took over the years, and his Saturday Night Live appearances are included in these diaries. So he wrote a little bit about this week where he was on the show. And I mean, if you're interested in Python at all, or Michael Palin, or even some of the side stuff he's done, very, very fun. Listen, I got it on Audible. He wrote bits and pieces like he was underwhelmed by the monologue. He did a lot of work to try to make it work. It was kind of something that was bothering him this week. One thing he did say was that at the read-through, Lorne Michaels was very happy with the material. And one sketch in particular, Palin mentions, that we do see on the show was so funny that the cast members could barely get through it with all the laughing going on. So I'll reveal that one when we actually get there. But Palin, it just always seems like such a nice fella. I mean, even the Pythons called him the nice Python.
Yeah, that's he certainly gives off that impression. And I remember hearing that as well. He was always one of my favorites. Him and Eric Idle were my two favorites. Mm.
You know, I could never pick a true favorite of the five performers. Gilliam, of course, had his role, but wasn't quite the performer. The rest of them were. Of the five performers, I'm always sure. I'm like, okay, today it's Terry Jones. And then, bam, I see something awesome from one of the other ones. It's really hard for me to pick.
Fortunately, we don't really have to.
So let's go right to the cold open. It's a State of the Union, and this starts with Bill Murray and John Belushi sitting there as Walter Mondale and Tip O'Neill. Announcer Ray McDougal, voiced by Tom Davis, says that Jimmy Carter was at one point not going to do the State of the Union address because of a serious, painful medical issue. And this is another one of those State of the Unions that cuts between the Saturday Night Live stuff and the actual house. And those were done for years. I think they still do them. So Carter, who in real life was suffering from hemorrhoids, walks into the podium in excruciating pain. He has a very stiff gait. He talks about the country being in good shape, but talks about irritating problems such as swelling inflation and that the vessels of economy are dangling in suspense, waiting for the problem to be rectified. Carter says he thinks he's put the finger on the problem. We do get a quick shot of Ted Kennedy with the Chyron saying next president. Carter proposes Preparation I, which will shrink the economy and shrink inflation. He then cuts the rest of the speech short because he just can't stand there anymore. And he delivers live from New York. I thought this was very funny. It was a perfect amount of time. It wasn't too long, wasn't too short. For some reason, I knew that Carter had a serious case of hemorrhoids in early January of 79. I don't know why I knew that. But even if I didn't, I think it's pretty clear in the speech based on what he says that we can sort of deduce what his medical issue is. I thought there was a lot of really good double entendres in here. Aykroyd's Carter is as strong as it's ever been. And I do like these ones where they intercut with the House, the elected officials watching. I definitely bet my money that this was a Franken and Davis piece.
I liked it okay. I get, you know, it's the cold open is generally a pretty topical spot of the show. And I had no idea about Carter's particular ailment of the time, but it was obviously disclosed quite plainly. But nevertheless, you know, it was fine. It was just a bunch of butt jokes. I guess I thought it was kind of lazy.
I kind of went the other way on it, but I can see why you said lazy. I can totally see them sitting there trying to come up with all these puns about hemorrhoids and how it applies to the economy. And I kind of went the opposite way with it and thought it was pretty clever what they were able to pull out.
I mean, it was very well paced, though. It didn't drag on too long at all. So like, it wasn't like I hated it or anything.
Aykroyd's Carter, still as strong as ever for you?
Yep. Still dig it. Still think he does a great job.
I liked it a lot. I thought it was a really good sort of strong start to the episode to let you know what you were in for. And I felt it clicked briskly without overstaying and, you know, didn't go over the top with the puns, but just enough without really overdoing it. I always forget that Dan does impressions. Like, I always think of Dan Aykroyd as playing more of the straight man character, that I don't see him doing the impressionist as much. And it's a nice treat to see.
We go to the intro and we see that there's a report going to be delivered by Father Guido Sarducci. We're also going to have an appearance by Franken and Davis tonight. There'll be a Franken and Davis show. So we are off to the monologue. Palin is very much overcome by the audience. He says it's great to have come 3,000 miles to host Saturday Night Live. He says the cast are absolutely great, but he needs to read their names off a sheet of paper, which turns out to be a grocery list. There's one lady in the audience that just hoots through the whole thing, and Palin sort of hangs a lampshade on her and calls her out. Palin says it's a near perfect show, except for the fact that he's wearing the wrong socks. He says he's trying to overlook it, but he can't help but focus on his wool socks. He has an allergy to wool, and he told the show that he needs socks that weren't wool. The show said they wouldn't give him wool socks, but they messed up despite having several sock vendors nearby. Palin tries to go on with the monologue, but he's getting increasingly annoyed with the lack of suitable socks. And he does a thing about how many good things they have given him, the show has given him, and how well they've treated him, but they just couldn't get it together on the socks. Palin is very likable, and this had its moments where I kind of laughed, and it was refreshingly simple, but there was something off here, something didn't work. The audience did seem to enjoy it, though.
Yeah, that lady went into business for herself, huh?
Big time.
I think it made it pretty fun, though, because otherwise, yeah, I thought it was pretty dreary. You know, I thought that his increasing frustration with the state of the socks was valid and funny, but I don't know. You're right. There was something missing. It felt really slapdash.
Yeah. He may have actually ad-libbed it rather than using the cards, if I recall what he was saying in the book.
Well, that's pretty interesting.
He'll get a point for me if that's true.
What I like about it is that, and it could be just the British humor of it, I love when somebody tells a story, the descriptors start being more the funnier part of joke, like the whole thing about the sock. But, you know, when he starts naming different materials, I get a kick out of it. And when, instead of just saying it was wool, he had to add that it was lamb's wool. Like, to me, that's something that I find both Canadian humor and British humor is something we're apt to do.
Yeah.
As far as openings go, it was middle, but high middle.
We're now off to the nerds. Huge reaction from the audience as the nerds enter. Todd and Lisa had just finished eating a big feed of beans and Franks. They do their regular routine, the back and forth noogies, jokes about breasts. She calls them pizza face. And they talk about Mr. Brighton. That's Lisa's piano teacher who made a pass at her in the last Michael Palin episode. Mr. Brighton's coming over to teach piano lessons. Todd refers to him as a pervert, and Lisa says that he's English. We get a great line from Todd where he says he may be English, but he's got Russian hands and Roman fingers. Palin enters as Mr. Brighton. Todd teaches Lisa how to play piano by ear, and he's banging his head on the keyboard. Mrs. Loupner then comes in, takes Todd downstairs to help her fold the contoured sheets. Mr. Brighton has brought Lisa some sheet music from Marvin Hamlisch's The Way We Were. And of course, we know that Lisa has a terrible crush on Mr. Hamlisch. Lisa starts playing, and Mr. Brighton again makes a move on her. Mrs. Loupner comes in. She's been drawn by Lisa's amazing music, even though Lisa's only doing the one finger piano. Todd then comes in wearing a bra as a blindfold. He thinks it's Lisa's, but it turns out to be Mrs. Loupner's. Todd and Lisa leave to return the bra, and Mrs. Loupner shows Mr. Brighton a picture of her late husband who was born without a spine. Mr. Brighton then puts the moves on Mrs. Loupner, but this is broken up by Todd and Lisa's return. Brighton admits that Lisa is his only student, and she and Todd and Enid are the only people he knows in the United States. Todd sings One is the Loneliest Number, and Brighton's manhood is stirred, and he hits on Todd. There's a lot to say about this one. First off, I like the familiarity of all the sayings that were so huge when I was a kid, and I wonder which ones came from here and which ones were just made popular by here. I thought Jane was awesome in this. Her reaction to being hit on was absolutely hilarious, and her ability to shut him down was great. Her line about Gilda playing The Way We Were was like the Pied Piper of Hamlisch was a great little pun. But I didn't think this one was strong as a lot of the other nerds. And while I appreciate the reappearance of Mr. Brighton, it was all kind of a bit of nothing. I really liked the nerds. And there's sometimes a frenetic pace to this that I thought was kind of lacking in this one. Certainly wouldn't say this was a bad sketch, but I certainly didn't enjoy it as much as I liked a lot of the other nerd sketches.
Very interesting you say that. I think this is the my favorite one that I've ever seen. I thought they got the usual routine jokes out of the way really quickly. And once they did, I was confident they wouldn't go back to them, and they didn't. And it gave it room to breathe. And Jane got to come in and do that hilarious bit where she's being hit on, as you mentioned. The relationship I just found continued to be fleshed out between them. Bill and Gilda, who I found much less annoying than usual, because you know I don't usually like these as much as you. But this one was different for me. I thought it was excellent.
It was definitely more subdued, and I know you have been critical of the way Gilda's voice gets Gilda's voice gets when she gets loud, and Bill's over talking and stuff like that, and a lot of that wasn't there this time
for sure. And I liked the ending too, where Michael Palin got weird all of a sudden.
weirder.
Yeah, you know what it is about the music.
Yeah, when they came out, I was like, okay, obviously these are characters that we have seen before, and I thought they were great. Jane Curtin, when they took off the glasses and you're still squinting, well, I can't, it's because I can't see. There's so many good lines in this one. Bill Murray's Watch Me Play by Ear.
Yeah,
I've never seen that pun joke before. It was a perfect dad joke, and I'll be honest, I'm going to steal it for the next time I'm at a party.
Yeah,
like it was great. I meant to write it down. Gene Kern's line about he was trying to loosen my virtue, but it's still uptight or something like that. Like all good episode, good lines.
We are now at a point, and it's been kind of building, but we're now at the point where the sight of a recurring character elicits a Pavlovian reaction from the audience right from the beginning. And it's only going to get worse from here. I mean, it will get better as the recurring characters sort of have to be reintroduced with a new cast and such. Like, what's your thought of that? Because, you know, on one hand, I think it's really cheap because you are clapping and loving something because it is a reflection of, you know, what it had been before, what made the character popular, not what you're going to see now. On the other side of it, I see, like, you know, they've already done the work. They've established the character, so let's go with it now. But this was the first time where it actually kind of pissed me off, because I said, even if this isn't funny, people are going to be laughing their heads off because they love these characters.
You got to give the people what they want. On television, you do need to have some familiarity, I think, to maintain success. So I do get it. But Sure, it's certainly, I think there's probably sometimes a very natural sense that you might not have to work as hard because, yep. You know what? They're going to carry this with their performance. So just throw some jokes at them and get back to work on the monologue because it stinks. I can see that happening.
Yeah.
To conclude, I think what really jumps into my head is it is television. While I do think it is cheap and kind of annoying, I totally get it, and it can still be used wisely.
Yeah, and I will say, like, characters like the nerds or Olympia Cafe or, like, the Coneheads, there seems to be, like, a progression here. We're not talking, like, the cheerleaders, which is basically the exact same thing 30 times, you know?
I can note that a lot of these recurring, like, this is my favorite one of these ever. The last Olympia Cafe was my favorite one of those ever. So these things are starting to land with me in... as they grow and find themselves.
So we now go to What If, and this one was written by Jim Downey. We have Matt's favorite, Joan Face, hosting What If. I think it's just your favorite name, isn't it? Joan Face.
Huge pop, Joan Face.
Like, Joan Face is no different from regular Jane Curtin, but something about the changed name makes it so much better, eh?
Subtle differences, yeah. She goes to 42nd Street after work instead of home to her husband.
So the question tonight was, what if Superman grew up in Germany instead of America? Garrett appears as Brigadier General Kevin Temple from the U.S. Air Force. Gilda is there as Elaine Houghton, a professor and comic book collector. Houghton gives a breakdown of Superman's history, that he was, you know, found in Kansas and grew up with American values. But if he'd been found in Prussia, he would have grown up with different values. Joan asks her to confirm that he probably would have become a Nazi. When Brigadier General Temple is asked what if Superman fought for the Nazis, he asked, why didn't Superman fight for the Allies? He's then reminded that this is a hypothetical situation, and he is cut off before he can give any answer. We then go to the Chancellery headquarters of the Third Reich. Michael Palin plays Hitler, and he talks about the Russians, and he gives a pecking order, like the Russians are one step above the Gypsies, and it goes down to about 15 steps where the Russians are, I think, 15 steps above homosexual Jewish people or something along them lines. Anyway, he gives a pecking order of his different groups. Hitler sends his cabinet out of the room. After the cabinet leaves, we get three reporters coming in from the Ministry of Propaganda, and they are Jimmy Olstein, played by Al Franken. Dan Aykroyd plays Klaus Kent, and Lorraine plays Lois Lainhoff. And Klaus is identified by Hitler as the man who beat Jesse Owens at the 36 Olympics. Klaus Kent is obviously a German version of Clark Kent, and he notices the ticking bomb in the suitcase. He runs into a nearby closet where he summons his father, played by Belushi, doing his Brando impression. Jor-El, I guess, tells Kent to use his powers for good, not to mess with the destiny of man and not to eat junk food. Bill then appears as an apparition of Klaus's Earth father, who tells him to use his powers for the fatherland. Kent rips off his clothes, revealing he is Uberman. He runs out of the closet and throws himself on top of the ticking attaché case and defuses the bomb in a very fun bit with the camera shaking and some smoke that is timed very poorly. He stands up and they ask how he knew there was a bomb in there. He says he has X-ray vision. Lois asks if he can see through her clothes, and he says he can, and he also identifies Jimmy Olstein as a Jewish man because he can see through his clothes. Jimmy says he's not Jewish. His parents had great knowledge of hygiene. Uberman says he'll fight for untruth, injustice, and the Nazi way, and flies off with the Jewish person who he promises to drop at the camps on his way to the Eastern Front. We then see some newspapers that say, Uberman was found rounding up Jewish people and killing everyone in England. And we then go back to the panel. Garrett says the U.S. Army would have put all their resources into kryptonite. And Gilda says England may have gone on to become the new homeland for the Jewish people. Okay, background on this. Christopher Reeve's Superman was just released a little over a month before. Huge hit. The lack of the politically correct language probably helped this a lot. You could technically do this sketch today, but I don't know if they'd use the hard language that really made this one over the top. I always love people making fun of Hitler, and Palin does it very, very well. It does remind me a little of his Pontius Pilate, which I truly enjoyed. Dan, Lorraine, and Franken, fantastic in this. Fun to see Belushi's Brando impression. Bill's bit about Klaus's Earth father was also very good. Great idea, a lot of fun, timely for what was going on in pop culture at the time. I was really, really impressed with this sketch, got a big kick out of it.
I thought it was pretty wild. There's something very British about this type of Nazi exploitation humor as well, yeah. I find. And yeah, Palin was, there's also something very 70s about having Nazis in things, still fresh bad guys. I guess, but I thought did you notice Dan got a bit of a pop when he took off his pants and went full uniform?
Absolutely. People went nuts.
It seemed to kind of freeze him for a second. I think even he was a little caught off guard. But anyway, yeah, I thought it was wild and zany and Belushi when he came out on screen like that. And it was long. It paced itself well. It was completely absurd. There's always something wild about seeing Nazi comedy that keeps things fairly fresh if you do it right.
I saw a sketch not too long ago. Someone was taking off Hitler, and it wasn't Michael Palin. So, I mean, they didn't have his chops. But they avoided using some words that kind of sting, and it really took the meat out of the sketch, I think.
Well, sure. Yeah, it's because it becomes some sort of watered down cartoon version of it.
So this was the right time for this. And I was thinking, you know, they could have done this exact sketch, you know, a year before the Christopher Reeve movie was all over the place. And it probably wouldn't have worked as well. But Superman was on people's mind.
Yeah. Hot topic. Strike those hot commodities while they are hot indeed.
Yeah. When I heard Uberman too, I laughed. Well, he took the thing off and I was like, why is it an O instead of, I thought it would be a swastika myself, actually, when he took the.
Yeah, me too. Maybe that would have been a little delicate. Despite that they were everywhere else, just having it like right on Superman's chest.
That might have pissed off DC if DC was a thing.
Yeah, as soon as they came on and asked the question, it was such a like, yeah, I've had that kind of conversation with my friends before, but just to see it done and the fact that it was sort of taken seriously in that regards of like having two professional talk, like a general from the military and a historian to talk about it, just added so much more humor to it. The sketch was great. Yeah, Dan Aykroyd did a good job. The whole bit where he forgets that they can take off his pants, but realizes it and then takes it off. The jokes were great. And like I said, Jimmy Olsen, or Olsenstein, but it's spelled EI, so it's okay.
He was Dutch.
Vision. Yeah, Dutch, yeah, on my father's side. I thought it was great.
We're now off to the Doobie Brothers. Their eighth album was called Minute by Minute. It had been released in December 78. It hit number one and went triple platinum. What a Fool Believes from Minute by Minute hit number one, probably the band's biggest and best known hit of the time. I'll be honest, I'm not a huge Doobie Brothers fan, but there's something about the sound, probably Michael McDonald's voice, that just smacks me with tons of good and bad nostalgia. And it's really for a time I didn't exist in, but this song hung around for a long time. Still played frequently when I was a kid. I definitely won't say the band is bad. On the contrary, I think they're actually quite good, and there's so friggin' many of them. It's very impressive what they can put together, but it's definitely not for me. I don't know what it is about that particular sound. I'm not going to say it was bad. It's just not my thing.
Interesting choice of musical guest. This kind of music on Saturday Night Live, it generally veers toward like the AM dad rock, or they'll go really overboard and have Devo or Patti Smith. Did you ever see that Family Guy bit with Michael McDonald?
Yeah, sure have. Yep.
It's such a puzzling voice.
Yeah.
I don't know if I like it. I don't know if I dislike it, but it's curious. I think the song is amazing. I think this is one of the better pop rock 70s songs that there is. It's just so fucking catchy, and he's so ridiculous. And my God, the sight of that band, the state of them.
I was watching, you know what I thought? Like, just looking at how none of them really match the same aesthetic. I was like, this is like leftovers from other bands, you know?
Sorry, something else I wanted to mention is Michael McDonald has no fucking onstage charisma or presence at all. He's just like hunched there playing his keyboard. He's doing a good job, but like he's going about his work.
He's there to play. He's a musician, not a performer. I think he gets more of that as time goes on. But no, he's there to work. Yeah. Definitely a unique voice, eh?
Yes. And I'm one for unique voices. You know, I like Geddy Lee and Billy Corgan and Yoko Ono.
Weekend Update. Jane and Bill again. It starts with a story about Fred Silverman collapsing after watching the debut of Hello, Larry. Do you know the Hello, Larry story? It comes up as a joke all over the place for like the next 15 years.
No.
So when McLean Stevenson left MASH, he became the star of Hello, Larry, and it was at one point considered to be the next great sitcom, but it completely tanks.
Okay. Not a spinoff.
No, but this is like one of the most high profile. I'm leaving this show for my own show, and my own show sucked.
Okay. Yes, I get you.
He left MASH in season 4. You know, it had another 7 years.
Yeah.
January is Alien Registration Month. So Bill swears in any illegal aliens who are watching the show, and he warns everyone that they go to hell if the flag touches the ground. Celebrity Corner, Woody Hayes, former coach of the Ohio State University team, was fired after hitting an opposing player. We visit with Woody Hayes and his wife, who are playing checkers in their kitchen at home, played by Belushi and Gilda. He says he's done coaching. He's glad to be home with his wife and family. His wife is pleased he's home as well. Her name is Charlene. She then triple jumps him on the checkerboard, and he attacks her as the segment ends. I guess that's attack number 8 or 9 from Belushi to Gilda. We then have a photo of Rosalind Carter with John Wayne Gacy, and then another one with Jim Jones. These are legit images that were taken. But Weekend Update has done some investigation, and they have found pictures of her with Charles Whitman, Charles Manson, and skiing with Richard Speck and Albert DeSalvo. Photos with Charles Starkweather and Ed Koch at dinner, and Koch denies ever having met Carter at dinner. Chico Escuela reports on Willie Mays, who always kept his eye on the ball. We then have clips of football players completing and missing passes because they either kept their eye or didn't keep their eye on the ball. We then get a report from Guido Sarducci. The Pope went to Mexico City for a bishop's conference, and Guido went along with them, and he wears a sombrero. He says that there were pickpockets all over the place, and the police have arrested about 2,000 people. He talks about the people he met, including a guy who had some relics to sell. He said he had Jesus' high school grad picture, but Guido couldn't identify him because he didn't have the beard and the long hair. There is a femur bone of St. Augustine. Guido didn't buy it because it was chipped. Then Guido got to see the bill for the Last Supper. The guy was selling it for $50,000. Guido couldn't afford it, so he bought the bill for the Last Brunch. And he shows us the bill for the Last Brunch dated 4/33. Bought this for $200. And the menu was basically 12 orange juice, 12 eggs benedicts, 12 lox and cream cheese, 12 home fries, 1 soft boiled egg, 12 coffee, and 1 tea. The total came to 155 shekels. They split it evenly at 11.92 shekels. The guy who had the egg and the tea had to pay as much as the rest of them. So Guido says the lesson is, if you go out with a group, always order the most expensive thing because everyone's going to share the cost. This Weekend Update to me, I thought was really, really strong. The Carter thing had me laughing. I mean, she did meet Jones and Gacy, and they went and had some fun with it. Definitely one of Guido's more memorable bits. It's hilarious. Originally, it was supposed to be the Last Supper. The censors wouldn't have it, so we went and did the Last Brunch, which makes it 10 times funnier. Chico was really great. Celebrity Corner, nothing special. Probably the weak bit of the segment, but all things considered, I really, really, really enjoyed this Weekend Update.
You know, the first couple of Guido appearances I wasn't so into. I am now 2 for 2 on the last ones. So that's really coming along for me. Yeah, the Celebrity Corner was a dud, though. Garrett Morris segment was kept nice and short. And of course, it's funny that he just refers to everything in these baseball cliches. So I'm still really into that. And the jokes were funny. Credit to Bill Murray, who's like, you know, I don't really talk about a lot in my thumping on about these anchor people, but he's holding his own. He's like way better than Dan. You know, it's certainly not my favorite, but proving quite competent.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Better than Dan was. I knew the Last Brunch thing was coming because it's kind of one of Guido's more famous things. I like his little in-between things that aren't written. Bill says, nice hat. He goes, yes, I got it in Mexico. And it's a friggin' sombrero.
I've seen still images of Father Guido, and I had no idea what to expect. He didn't disappoint. I think my only complaint was with Father Guido was he should have been used in that Walter Matthau episode, because I felt that Weekend Update fell flat and he would have saved that one. Like, I felt like, again, it was a really, really tight joke. Everybody was at their A game with everything. And then him was just an added bonus and a real treat.
Yeah. We are now off to Miles Cowperwaith. So Michael Palin plays Miles, and he's reading excerpts from a book, The Wretched Birth, Miserable Childhood, Agonizingly Painful Adolescence, and Appallingly Vile and Degrading Death of Miles Cowperwaith. And this is a Charles Dickens classic. So we're going to see a wonderful Charles Dickens parody here. Over a series of images of period sketches, Miles narrates his life up to this point. He relates the birth of his father 2 years before he was born, his mother's death a year later, and then her second death again later. He was then found in a bottle in a cess barge. And as a kid, he went to meet the Crimean ships that were coming in, and he was allowed to eat the soiled linen. He ran away at 2 and got a job picking the noses of Cornish fishermen. In 1842, he earned money by serving parts of his body to dogs, and then he was invited to the home of a benefactor in the Northamptonshire countryside. So we join Miles as he's entering the manor with Jane playing a Cockney housekeeper. She tells him to mind his manners and to tend to his duties. Lord Pickney, Miles' new master, is a kind man who has two afflictions. Firstly, he salivates constantly and needs a drool bucket to be permanently under his chin, and he also falls into fits where he thrusts himself into people's personal spaces. Aykroyd comes in all aged up as the new master. He has a little tin under his chin to catch the drool. He greets Miles and starts twitching and falls into Miles with drool falling all over the place. And the fit stops when Jane's character hits him over the head with a vase. He's very grateful to her and he thanks her and gets his drool bucket replaced. Miles says he became accustomed to life. And as we see him dumping various little drool buckets into a larger bucket, which is absolutely disgusting, he went to a nearby groundskeeper's homes where he met a beautiful young girl named Kate, who's played by Lorraine. Kate has been dying for as long as anyone remembers, and all the groundskeeper and games wardens in England were consulted, and their verdict was that only a doctor could save her. Bill plays Kate's father, Tom, one of the groundskeeper, and he's using his kind of his honker voice. He asks if she might live, but Lord Pickney says she might already be dead. Kate says she's still alive and wants to rest and doesn't want anyone to be troubled on her account. Pickney, while visiting Kate, goes into one of his fits again and gets a thing smashed over his head. Having fallen in love with Kate, Miles hopes to settle down when he finds out he's been sold to Captain Ned. And we meet Captain Ned, it's Belushi, and his cabin boy Hodo, who are both flamboyant effeminate, we find out later. They were gay. Ned tells Miles it's time to be a man and to see the world as a man should on a man's ship. And he lists all the ports they're going to visit on the ship, which include San Francisco and Key West. Lord Pickney and the rest of the household say they're going to miss Miles. Miles says he'll be back to see Kate, but they all agree that she'll be dead by that time. Lord Pickney has another attack. We then go back to the book where Miles says he found happiness for a time but lost it. In the next chapter, we'll hear about his voyages on the Raging Queen, and the chapter is called Nailed to the Hull. So stay tuned on this one. I am a Dickens fan, and I thought this was an awesome send-up of a Dickens book. Everyone was miserable. Everyone in this sketch was absolutely perfect and perfectly Dickensian. Except maybe Garrett, who might have camped it up a little more than necessary. This was an absolutely perfect parody. There is another Miles Cowperwaith coming down the line that is the more memorable one, but this was certainly a great setup for that.
Yeah, I agree. Just the right amount of over the top. I remember the amount of groans when Dan Aykroyd thrusting himself onto Michael Palin. Like, the audience just was on board. It was perfect cliche of way you would want to sum up a Charles Dickens book.
Terrific, disgusting, weird. I thought there was a bit of a lull there in the middle, but it kind of picked up again at the end. But yeah, it was pretty nasty. And I really felt like this is the same guy that was probably involved as well in the movie Nothing But Trouble.
Yeah, same character. Yeah. Our next segment is the Doobie Brothers back again singing Taking It to the Streets, released on the album Taking It to the Streets in 1976, hit number 13 in the U.S. Thought this was faster paced and more enjoyable than the first one. It still had the nostalgic feeling. I much preferred this. The band was so excited at the end of this. It looked like it was the first time they ever played it live. They were really happy with how well they did. And that was kind of infectious. So I did kind of enjoy this one.
I was on board with the Doobie Brothers. Not that I'm a big fan of their music. I know few of the songs, like the popular ones, like the two that they're played today. Yeah, I thought they did a really good job as musical guests.
Matt, you were a big fan of the first one. Where are you at on this one?
Yeah, I feel about the same. What an odd voice, and he's all business on stage. And wow, what an interesting Rob Zombie movie looking bunch of characters these people are. I'm a little surprised that you think this is a better song than What a Fool Believes. But I really like What a Fool Believes, as I've mentioned. I think that's a top shelf song.
Speaking about all business, you hear the title Doobie Brothers, and you look at everybody but Michael McDonald, and you go, oh yeah, yeah, definitely could be Doobie Brothers. And then he's like 80s yuppie, like he could have been. He could have been Lewis's brother from Die Hard. Like
he did join later. He joined the band after they were named. So he came.
Oh, that would explain.
Yeah. He came up with 3 years. Something tells me too, this might have been, they had another lead singer who had left, and this might have been one of their first public appearances without that guy. Our next sketch was written by Brian McConaughey, and it's called Name the Bats. This is a game show featuring Michael Palin as Jerry, the host. You keep your last names in your pocket on this game show. And the show features guests played by Gilda and John, known as Joan and Steve. The setting is basically the front of an old barn, and John and Gilda are locked in a barn where they have to name all the bats. When they first get in, they don't see any bats, so Michael Palin hits the outside of the barn to wake up the bats in the rafters. We then hear the bats squeaking and John and Gilda just screaming. As this is happening, the set starts to fall apart. Jerry gets annoyed with them and is yelling at them because they're not naming the bats. So John and Gilda start yelling out like vampire bat, fruit bat, but he's really angry because he wants them to actually name them, to give them names. Nothing too fancy, he says. He then lets them out and they're horrified. He says they didn't win the big money because they had a hard time with the rules. He said, it's one of my favorite lines. It's a beautiful game when it's played well. He then says they're not going to go home empty handed, but because they don't have a home version of the game, they get 2 more minutes with the bats. This was a brilliant piece. Always love when Michael Palin plays a smarmy, sleazy host, like Monty Python Blackmail was the first thing that jumped up in my mind. Crazy, bizarre idea. John and Gilda are absolutely great. Her screams, his horrified look was hilarious. This obviously, it does have a very Python-esque feel to it. Also had a bit of a Kids in the Hall feel to it. I just thought this was, it was short as hell, but it was friggin' brilliant. I laughed through the whole thing, and I've watched it about 6 times since. So thumbs up on Name the Bats.
I didn't like as much. I thought the same thing. I was like, out of all of them, this had the most strongest, like, Python vibes. I just didn't find it as funny. And I was really excited at first because when I saw Name the Bats and it had the Batman symbol, I was like, oh, okay, we're going to do something, another superhero get. And then with Name the Bats, I was like, okay, well, I'll get along with this. But yeah, I like, there was jokes I enjoyed, but I think, honestly, out of the sketches, that probably was one of my least favorite ones.
Interesting.
I thought it was fast and weird and absurd and funny. And when I realized that he wanted to actually give them names, I laughed out loud, especially like nothing too weird. Like, you know, names people would know. It's just awesome. And yeah, a beautiful game when it's played well. I definitely made a note of that. I thought it was fantastic. It's a good late show sketch. It's weird and it's a little horrifying.
So this is the one in his diary. Michael Palin talks about a sketch they couldn't get through because they were laughing too hard. This is the sketch. Yeah, at the table. Also, too, this sketch didn't, thanks to Ian Talks Comedy. He does a really good podcast. He did an interview with Brian McConaughey where this didn't get on dress rehearsal. McConaughey remembers it not being rehearsed because a previous sketch took too long. They were so sure that this was going to be a hit and it didn't need much, so they just did it. Either way, the set falls apart as he's banging on the barn.
I laugh, but I don't know. I guess because it started off such a strong, like, oh my, it had the Python vibe. Maybe I was just like, I'm going to expect more out of this one.
Yeah.
It just was never going to reach to a delivery that it could possibly make.
Pretty high bar, you know.
Yeah, a high bar, exactly.
That happened to me with the last Michael Palin episode for sure. There was one sketch I remember at the very beginning thinking, this is it. It was the Sherlock Holmes sketch. Matt, do you remember that one?
Yes.
Yeah. So I first saw it and I thought the same thing. You know, the historical stuff that Python did, I really thought it was going to nail it, and it fell short, unfortunately. Our next segment is the Franken and Davis show. And this week they come out in front of the curtain as usual. Welcome us to the show. Davis reminds the audience that they are international communist revolutionaries. They welcome Gilda and Lorraine as their guests for tonight. Both Gilda and Lorraine come out. They say they're delighted to be a part of the show. Gilda says she's been waiting for the day that the world is ruled by one Marxist government. Lorraine says they should all pitch in to make things wrong. With that in mind, they're going to make some television pornography at Dallas Cowboy Stadium. We then go to Dallas Cowboy Stadium, or I guess Cowboy Stadium, where Tom plays a cowboy coach, Coach Landry, thinly veiled parody of Tom Landry. He meets two sisters in his office who would like to be cheerleaders. Tom then calls in Jackie Watts, played by Franken. Franken's sweater says 13 and a half, and I think we know what that means. The sisters then start rubbing the men's backs. This whole porn thing is kind of it's all about back rubbing and making people's backs feel better rather than actual full-on porn. They get the sisters to start rubbing each other's backs. Tom contributes a back scratcher. Basically, you know, this is an early parody of pornography. I thought the set and the bad acting, the camera work, really on point. Problem here is there was no real explanation as to why it was all about back rubbing rather than many other possibilities that would have been perfectly legal. Probably a really funny sketch at the time, but it has been done to death, like porn parody. Not parody porn, that's done too, but porn parody has been done so many different ways. I think it's just a victim of having been topped later.
I think a lot of the notes that I had written. I, of course, was watching it on my lunch break at work and felt very embarrassed. I have my headphones on, but I had to make sure, like, oh God, are my headphones really working? Like that panic. So is somebody hearing this right now? How would I explain what I was watching? Like, probably one of the first ones done in that regard. And I think, yeah, they did a really good job with the camera work and the bad acting. I liked it.
I thought it was pretty good too. I was actually surprised that they went as far as they did with it, with the ooing and the face shots. Maybe it's just me, but there's something absolutely pornographic about the big disco hair. I thought it was really funny. I thought they did a good job leaning into the Franken and Davis stuff. I don't think I liked it as much as at first, but it's growing on me, these young up-and-comers.
One thing I did note, it was nice to see, like, we've seen 70s pornography parodied a million times, but I don't know if I've ever seen it parodied in the time it actually existed. You know what I mean?
Right? Yeah, that's cool.
It just goes to prove that the more recent parodies are not so far off either, right? We now go to Mr. Bill. Mr. Bill is going to be sued by Sluggo because Spot bit him on the leg, and Spot has rabies. Mr. Bill is then taken to court, and Sluggo is the judge. Bill loses his hand to the gavel. Spot is made with a ball and chain around his neck and foam all over his face. They put a big needle in him and determine that he does have rabies. The jury is shown, and they are also a bunch of Sluggos. Mr. Bill's mother shows up to testify. She says he's a good little boy. Sluggo takes her into the back room, where he's going to investigate her a little bit more. As Mrs. Bill reemerges completely mangled and says her son is a spoiled brat. Mr. Bill then gets several books thrown at him, and then he gets fried in the electric chair. This is far and above the best Mr. Bill I've ever seen. I laughed through this whole thing. I don't remember ever seeing this one before. I loved it. I thought it was great.
I concur. Out of the ones I remember as a little kid and the one I just saw recently, this was the best one.
Yeah, I usually like them anyway, but I do agree. And I think I would like to note that the reason I do like it so much is because we are taken even further into this weird existential hell that is Mr. Bill's universe. I find it quite a nightmarish hellscape, to be honest with you. When I saw all the jury members were Sluggos, I felt some weird sinking panic in my chest. I don't know. Maybe I need to lay off the pot. What can I say? I always like these, and they just keep making it even more bizarre.
We are now off to the Good Knights, holding a bunch of socks. Michael Palin says these socks were sent in as far away as Decatur and Pittsburgh. The cast is really, really excited up there, really happy. Carly Simon is called up on stage. She was a friend of John's at the time. I fucking hate that shit. She wasn't in the show. Keep her down. There's no friggin' reason to bring her up on stage. Not that it's Carly Simon. I hate that all the time. If you're not in the show, you don't get to bow. Screw you. All right, let's wrap this one up. So let's rate the host. I thought Michael Palin was excellent. He was definitely a little understated in the last one, but this one he was fantastic. He was all over the place. He did a ton of different things. Monologue was a bit blah, but everything else he did was awesome. We got to see an over-the-top Hitler. We got to see his sleazy host. We got to see innocent Miles Cowperwaith. Just thought this was really an excellent tour de force.
Agreed. He did a great job hosting. Yeah, the fact that he comes back again, you know, even if I'm not guest hosting, I'm definitely going to be checking it out. It was a really, like, one of the strongest episodes that I had the chance to review. Everything about it was, yeah, especially compared to how Walter Matthau went. It's sort of you could tell when you have a veteran up there who's been in these comedy things before how it's supposed to flow. And it was great.
Great job by Michael Palin. Down for anything, full of energy, great in everything he's in, showed a lot of different characters, seemed to have a lot of fun, good energy. I don't think you can ask anything more of a host. And there was some unique stuff that I think only he could pull off. Geez, what more can you ask? I think it was a home run as far as a hosting gig goes.
Music. I'm not a fan of the Doobie Brothers. They did what they did well. Second song I preferred to the first. I thought going in I wouldn't like the Doobie Brothers. I left thinking, yeah, I did kind of like the Doobie Brothers. So maybe that's a win.
No, it was just them sort of just almost like just jamming. Like, oh, we're just going to sit down, play it easy. I really enjoyed the music. Makes me want to go maybe, yeah, seek out a little bit more other tracks and songs.
Me too. I dug it. I do not sit around and listen to the Doobie Brothers on a regular basis. But, you know, I say that, but I've also had What a Fool Believes on my offline playlist, which is, of course, your on-the-go playlist, several times throughout my life in both original and cover versions. So it was a real treat for me to hear it live. So thumbs up.
Awesome. So, fellas, what's the worst sketch of the night?
See, that's a hard one. Like, they were all good. Like, but yeah. I think because I wanted it to be the best, that I let it down. It has to be the bats, but I know that's going to be complete opposite of what you guys are going to say.
Maybe. Matthew?
My least favorite sketch of the night was the cold open. I thought it was a lot of lazy butt jokes. And for me to go to the cold open, that's a pretty, not that it's not a sketch, but you know, it does occupy sort of like a its own special area of the show where it gets to be maybe super hyper topical. And this was, but I still thought it was a bunch of butt jokes that I couldn't get into.
Yeah, like the cold open, the monologue, and update are almost kind of in their own little category, eh?
They are, and that's why I was reticent to say that. But, I mean, it is what it is. It was, considering this, what I felt was the strength of the rest of the episode, it started off kind of clunky.
I went with the Franken and Davis TV porn. Probably not for their fault. Not even their fault. Just I've seen it done better since. What was your favorite sketch of the night?
Uberman, hands down. Uberman. John Belushi's Marlon Brando impression, and them just even talking about it, and the fact the X-ray vision to see that Jimmy was a Jew. Like, it was just ridiculous. And I think that's my favorite one.
Sean called it. My favorite sketch of the night was the bats. I thought it was quick, crazy, off the wall, unexpected. It's exactly what I like in a late night sketch comedy show. I loved it.
I was very impressed with three: Uberman, the bats, and Miles Cowperwaith. And I actually rewatched a few of them. I had to do really a few watches here. Ultimately, I did go with bats, though. Sean, you were right there, because of the simplicity of it. That could be done anywhere, and it was just something about how simple it was and yet how funny it was. So who was your star of the night, fellas?
I had it tied between Michael Palin and Dan Aykroyd. I felt both of them were just bringing a strong A game.
You got to give me one.
I'm going to give it to Michael.
Okay, Matt?
My two-horse race was Dan Aykroyd and Jane Curtin. I went with Jane Curtin because I thought, Dan was excellent throughout, you know, it's unfair to him because my expectations are very high. And I find watching Jane get to do new things is more exciting. Mm-hmm. And therefore, it's more titillating for me to watch. And Joan Face, come on.
Yeah, I don't know what's in the water, Matt, but you and I are agreeing a lot tonight. Jane, I was kind of a toss-up between Jane and Palin. And I said really early on for myself, if there's a not ready for primetime player in the race, that's where I'm going. Jane was excellent in the Mrs. Loupner getting hit on. She was fantastic. Joan Face is, as Matt said, always a joy. We got to see her Cockney again, which I've always enjoyed. We don't get to see too much. So yeah, I went with Jane. Could have been Dan, could have been Palin. Even Belushi, though he was not around much tonight, I thought he was pretty darn funny. Yeah, could have gone a lot of different ways. Overall, I'm a big Michael Palin fan. I was very kind of let down by the last one. So I kind of went into this one with lower expectations. I should not have. This was an excellent show. It was really all over the place with different comic stylings, and all of it was hilarious. Naturally, there's a Python feel, but I think that's inevitable if there's a Python hosting. I thought the sketches were impeccably written and performed. Update was very, very good. And even the sketches that weren't as good were still very good. And in the case of like Franken and Davis, they were only hurt by, I think, other things that were to come. The music didn't do it for me too much. Not that it was bad, just far from my interests, and kind of stuck in the middle of a genre that I'm just not a big fan of. We are kind of at the point, I mentioned it earlier, where the audience is almost hurting the show. Their familiar reactions, like the woman hooting in the audience, laughing at broken set, that sort of thing is going to hurt this show. So it's now something that I kind of going to hurt the show in my eyes. It's now something I'm going to have to be looking past more than I'd like to this early. The audience really annoyed me in this episode, to be honest with you. But beyond that, I thought this was a really, really, really good show. Music could have been better for me, but not that I didn't think it was good. So I actually gave this one a 9 out of 10. Really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I loved it too. I gave it an 8.5. As I haven't watched very many, so I didn't want to go really strong 9 and then also find something better and be stuck trying to rationalize. So yeah, 8.5.
Really good. It was really good. I've already said I didn't like how it opened, and the monologue was weird and a little weak, but I really thought he was trying with it, and so I appreciated that gumption. And then the sketches got rolling, and once they got rolling, man, they never really slowed down. It was really fresh, and everything felt different and vibrant, and even when they used characters that they've used before, they've kept them interesting. They didn't beat old jokes to death, and I think there has to be a lot of credit given there. The performances were great, the production was great, and I liked the music. So with there really only being that one slip up at the beginning, the one thing that gives me pause from giving this an outrageously good ranking is that, what will I remember? What am I taking away as a strong memory of this show? And I guess while I liked everything, nothing was really tattooed for me, but I just feel like it lacked that one over the top thing. Kind of softer open. This is a public service, so I take this seriously, and it pains me almost to say, but I would have to give this an 8.5 out of 10.
I was looking at your other scores from the season as you were saying it, and you would have done a terrible disservice to this episode if you gave it anything under an 8 based on your other choices.
Good.
So with my 9, Matt's 8.5, Sean's 8.5, this gets an 8.7. We are 1.5 above the folks at the IMDb who gave this a 7.3. This is a reverse exchange rate, Matthew.
Wow.
Yeah.
We dig it.
I guess we're bigger on the Pythons, because with the Eric Idle episode a couple of weeks back, we were also above. So maybe we like Python more than the IMDb users do. The IMDb ranks this one as the 10th best of the season. We are not tracking with that at all for us so far. This is way towards the top. It's actually our number one right now, I think, of the season.
That's how I feel about it.
Yeah, I'm kind of up there. There's a lot of good stuff in here. When we do our season 4 best of, there's 3 that might make this list. Cool. So, Sean, thank you very much for joining us tonight. This was a really fun episode to do. I'm glad you could sit in on a Python with us.
Yes. Part of me hopes I can do more, but, in more with the Pythons, but I'll be happy just to see any, really.
So. Yeah, and we're going to see Palin again this season and next season as well. I'll slot you in for next season.
Fantastic. Well, thanks for having me again, guys.
Oh, yeah, no worries at all. Anytime. So, Matt, do you know who's hosting next week?
Lay it on me.
Next week's host is Cicely Tyson. She was an EGOT, I think.
Ooh.
She got the honorary, so she's kind of an EGOT, you know what I mean?
Uh-huh. Do they count?
She didn't win an EGOT, but she got an EGOT. Yeah, just passed away at 96. She worked her whole life. Tremendous actor, anyway. And the musical guest is the Talking Heads.
Hell yeah!
You are a fan?
Yeah, I love the Talking Heads. Talking Heads are awesome.
Adrian does as well. She'll be joining us for that one. I also know frequent panelist Chili has become a huge Talking Heads fan. I know a little bit, but not much. So I'm interested to see what we're going to get here.
Yeah, that's exciting. This is the kind of music I've been waiting for on the show all along. I feel like I've been waiting for season four. This has really been a good season for me.
Nice. The Chieftains are coming up.
Oh, that's too bad.
Matt and I will be back in about a week. But until then, we'll be naming the bats here in SN Hell.